Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
The problem came when ego comes into play.
Because like establishing credibility is always the hardest thing. The biggest power you have is will just actually be very good at what you do.
I realized I don't need nutrition to do this business. I need business to do this business.
When I took over my father's business, I hated the fact that I was sitting in that seat. My dad's dead. And I'm sitting here because he's dead. Sometimes it's like, you know what? You're a prick, and I'm not going to work with you.
Each client comes with a different mindset to you, right? And just the gender makes a difference.
I'm not going to use up valuable time dealing with this.
Like in your business as well, the main concern that people have is that guy a good guy that I can trust with my money? That's the interesting part about selling houses, because the visualization will only come from the women, not from the man.
Entrepreneurs in particular, you think they have this early goal from when they were like 12. And they're going to change the world. And then set up this business. Like, it's not how it works.
One main thing that I realized very early on is that I need to first capitalize on the network that I already have. Letting people know in your own community what you're doing is more important than letting some random person know what you're doing.
Welcome, welcome everyone to another episode of Everyday Empires. I am here with Moiz Ahmed. Welcome, Moiz, to the show.
Thank you, sir. Really appreciate it.
Moiz is a serial entrepreneur, and now he's currently based out in Dubai, building out an incredible real estate empire.
The way you've said it is too good, man. I feel the pressure now, you know?
I know you've got a number of things that you do, but how do you like introduce yourself to, just so the audience get a little flavor of who you are?
So, well, my name is Moiz. I am from Dubai. I was born and raised there. I lived in London for a couple of years, had a good time here for university before COVID happened. And going back into Dubai life was a bit hard, but we started off into the marketing business. And through that, I kind of got an idea of what type of businesses I want to go into. So once I got into that, I think I figured out that sales was the way to go for me because of my people skills, to be very honest with you. That's how I met you. So,
oh, yeah, true.
There you go, right? And to be fair, I think I never really thought about real estate in that way because my father is in construction. So I wanted to sway away from that norm of engineering and all that. So I was trying to figure out a way to kind of make him happy but be happy myself. And then real estate was kind of the calling that I got. And honestly, with the market, you've known from the COVID time how it's been. It was very interesting from the money perspective for sure. But even just from a networking perspective, it was one of the best things I could have done. So I started with real estate marketing. And that was where I met and networked with most of the big agencies and kind of got the insights on the market. Mm-hmm. And then we moved into actually selling it eventually. And now I've been in the industry for about a year now. And alhamdulillah, I can't complain. I've done really well. Yeah.
Usually before we kick everything off, we ask every guest a question. Now, it's a question you haven't had time to prepare for, but don't worry. It's not crazy.
Okay.
What is your biggest mistake to date?
Ooh, honestly, it's a deep one. But I think when I was studying in the UK, I kind of regret going back early. And the reason I say that is because I had never stepped out of Dubai in terms of living and meeting people from outside. And when I did move, I was basically taken aback by the new culture that I'm seeing. Obviously, the international exposure you have in Dubai is great, but in the UK, it's a bit more different because the UK culture itself is brand new for you. So if I had stayed here and I maybe had understood the work culture here as well, I think that would have set me up even better than where I am right now. But I don't know if I had stayed here, would that be a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, time will tell, right? At the end of the day.
The hypothetical is always difficult to measure. But like, what, so why did you go back early? What was the trigger?
So I was studying. Now, that's another topic to get into. Mm. And so my parents wanted me to become a doctor, which every Pakistani Indian parent wants their kid to be.
Naturally.
So I was a very much an athlete type of guy. I was into sports. I played a lot of football, a lot of cricket. And to be very honest, I wanted to be a professional athlete at some point. Obviously, I needed to kind of keep my parents happy, try to figure out a way to, let's just say, get the best of both worlds. So I found a middle ground, and that was somewhere around sports sciences. So during IB, so I did the International Baccalaureate program in school. And during that time, I didn't really do well academically. I passed it, but honestly, it didn't really get me anywhere. And I didn't really learn much, to be honest. But the concept of just organization was great. So I decided that for my mother, I would do something in sports science and make it seem like I'm doing a bachelor's in science degree, which is pretty cool. And then I realized when I got into that degree, I studied at University of Hertfordshire. Great campus, got a sports scholarship, great place to be. But honestly, it just wasn't for me. And luckily, I had the balls to ask my father, like, Dad, I'm not really enjoying it. So would you mind if I come back and figure it out and kind of restart? And honestly, that was the time where me and my father's relationship kind of took another level, you know, and I respected that. And then I moved back to Dubai and studied international business at the Canadian University of Dubai.
Wow, that's quite a strong conversation to have with your father, because you must have been, what, like late teens, early 20s?
So I was in the early 20s, about 21, turning 21, yeah.
And do you find that's quite common in the South Asian community where your parents have all these kind of high expectations, hopes, ambitions for you, which most parents should do, obviously. Mm-hmm. But when there's the pressure of becoming that doctor, that engineer, that lawyer, accountant, whatever these like classic headline sort of bits are, how do you find people navigate that, the level of expectations?
Well, to be fair, I think it's also dependent on their surroundings, because I think people with siblings and without siblings, that's a major category that you need to think about. So for me, I am the youngest son of three older sisters, and there's a massive age gap. Like, my older sister is 19 years older than me. So I treat her like my mother, you know what I mean? And at home, it's like having four moms just telling you what to do. And honestly, they've done well because I always had someone to talk to in a different way. So when it comes to the standard, I think because of my sisters, there was already an expectation level. Once that level was set, and when I was growing older, I realized that, oh, look, your sister did this. Your sister got these type of grades. What the hell are you doing? When you start hearing those things, there's two things that would happen. Either you get motivated to go towards that, or you become rebellious. Now, I'll leave it to perception, but I took the latter route, the rebellious side, where I was like, I'm going to do completely the opposite thing, and I'm going to do what I want to do. And to be fair, it's still, I'm turned out pretty decently, I think. But when it comes to those type of choosing career situations, honestly, I think with modern parents, and I respect my parents about this, my dad is 72 years old. For him, dealing with a 25, 24-year-old guy just getting out of university, figuring out his life, is not easy. So he's going to have his opinions. But one thing I respected, that he let me do whatever I needed and figure it out myself. And if I did fall, he helped me back up and then pushed me towards the right area. So honestly, to answer that question, it's all about the pressure your parents put on you. And I think the modern parents have adapted really well to the new community and new, let's just say, I don't know how to explain it, but just the expectations that people have from the kids these days.
So say someone's listening to this who perhaps their parents are a little bit more forceful, they're a little bit more, let's say, hopeful, they're pushing down certain career paths. What advice would you give them to kind of manage those expectations? Because, you know, obviously I'm from a similar community, and the expectation, I mean, my mother wanted me to become a doctor, but you know, for just because there were, like, the common phrase that was sort of made was that it'd be nice to have a doctor in the family. You know, which I think was, which is fair, right? You have your lawyer in the family, you have your engineer in the family, your accountant in the family, and we have plenty of accountants mulling around. So naturally, doctors was the next thing. And it was, but she was always, she was kind of like, it'd be nice if you did it, because I was quite academic, but I didn't like sciences. Numbers were my game. So that's why I went down the accountant route. But I wasn't ever forced. It was just kind of, I kind of naturally went down there. But I know there's loads of friends, I'm sure you have many as well, where the mother or the father are like, you need to do this and you need to have a career and it has to be in one of these kind of categories so that we can tell other people, the community, that you are successful and that's a sign of our success.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of freaking pressure, man.
It is.
How would you advise people to navigate that and deal with it?
Honestly, the interesting thing you've said is that the pressure you have from your surroundings, right, it's also based on the family itself. So let's just take an example of some of my friends in Dubai. Now, most of my friends and one of my really good friends, Yash, your brother-in-law. So we have friends who are pretty much
business owners. I'm a big fan.
Oh, I love that. Love that. So we've got a lot of friends who actually come from a business background. Now, their biggest pressure in life is that whatever they do, they have to end up taking over that business. They might be the only son, they might be the only daughter, but they need someone to take the responsibility. So to navigate on that is a tough one because some people, some of them friends I have, they're really good at understanding, okay, I need the experience and I need to get to that level to actually take over rather than me working under my dad and then figuring it out, you know? Because even in the workspace, once you get in, and you probably know that as you're a business owner as well, that people need to respect you to understand and listen to what you're saying and actually follow your lead. If you don't have that, then who the hell is going to listen to you, right? So to be honest, there's only one way to navigate it is whatever you think is right. If you think it's right, you do what you do. Otherwise, let people judge you. That's fine. You learn from those mistakes you make and then you figure it out.
My late father's, one of his most common phrases that he would ever tell me, which I kind of didn't appreciate at the time, but I do really now, is that he always told me, do what you think is right. Exactly. And at the time, I was sort of like, well, obviously, I'm not going to do what I think is wrong, am I? You know, it's an arrogant little shit. But like over time, I realized that actually that was his way of kind of saying, I trust you to make the judgment.
Yeah.
But, you know, just have in the back of your mind your own assessment. Don't just go with the flow. Like, really understand why you're making this decision. Mm. I ended up ticking a lot of boxes anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe he was sort of hypnotizing me.
Yeah.
But like, I know a lot of parents where they don't do that. Like, they're like, you do this. And if you don't, I'll, you know, they embarrass the child, they'll shame them.
Yeah.
Maybe even in a public setting. It can be brutal. And I think the South Asian community, like, especially, I know parents don't mean to do it, all comes out of love, right?
Literally,
it all comes out
of
caring. Like, they desperately want their child to do well because they know if they've got their child a good career, that means they probably will marry someone in a similar community or similar area, which also means they're successful, means they're going to have a financially secure future, their kids are going to be fine. So all that worry of having to deliver, and you know, bearing in mind, all our parents are immigrants, right?
Immigrants,
so your parents went to Dubai. In this case, obviously, my grandparents came to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that mentality of, we've got to hustle, work hard, we're not part of this community, we need to like drive, we need to hit it big. And after one or two generations, if you can say your son, daughter is a doctor, insane. I mean, it is incredible. It is an amazing achievement.
Mm-hmm.
So I get it. But what if, like, as you say, what if you want to become a professional athlete?
Yeah.
I mean, it's very difficult to become one. You need commitment. You need drive. Mm-hmm. You can't become, I mean, there's a few people that can become a doctor and still pursue a professional career in sports. So where you've seen your friends kind of really go through those challenges of, my parents on my back, and maybe they're succeeding, but they don't have the passion for it, or maybe they're not succeeding, and they're getting a little bit, you know, a little bit weighed down. How do you help them through it? Because I want listeners to understand that the toughness of having to just kind of push through.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have it, some people don't.
Yeah.
And for those that don't, I think that's crucial, this bit of advice.
Yeah. Well, honestly, the way you have to live with it is also by surrounding yourself with like-minded people, which is the most important thing in my life, all right? And I've surrounded myself with like-minded people in a way that you can think about it. Let's say if you're a business owner, the way you think and the way you go ahead with your life is very different. You're traveling the world, you're meeting different type of people, you're dealing with relationships in a different manner. You don't have timings. You know that better than anyone. You could be working from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and that's a normal day, right? And when it comes to that, the only way you can kind of figure out what you're doing is right and wrong is by feeling accomplished by setting your targets well. So let's say, for example, I might have a small circle of friends. As long as my week goes well and I can at least have some sort of way to switch off a little bit, That way I'm going to keep going. I'll be motivated to work towards something. And one of the most important things, and we've had this conversation between us off camera, obviously, but it's more about figuring out those targets that you've set yourself on a quarterly basis or a monthly basis that you work towards, because it allows you to at least know what the hell you're going to be doing, right? So to be fair, I mean, going back to the whole cultural thing, another factor that you need to keep in mind is where you're based. In Pakistan and India, the mentality is completely different. But in the UK and Dubai, you're living a completely different type of lifestyle. So some people are actually just surviving just to keep that social pressure, you know, ticked off. You know, okay, I'm going out to DIFC, which is like one of the fancier places in Dubai, on a regular basis. And people think that I'm rich. People think that I'm successful, even though I might end up with probably 10 dirhams in my account. But, you know, it's one of those things that people are trying to please other people. So you need to figure out ways to keep yourself content with life. Yeah.
It does definitely come from a place of love and care.
Yeah.
If you extract the principles from that, so like, okay, your mother wants you to become a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But what she's really saying is she wants you to have a safe career that's respectable, that people will look up to, that people know that you have a level of kind of...
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Financial security, job security in life. Because obviously,
yeah.
A human in the UK is the same as, well, I hope so. Human in India,
yeah.
Human in so I get it. Like it's one of the ultimate safe jobs in the world. So
yeah.
It comes from a place of care and protection.
Of course.
If you don't want to pursue it, you don't want to pursue it. That's okay.
There you go. Yeah.
But if you extract those principles of, okay, man, this is what my parents want.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's a great principles to have in life anyway. You're not going to have an unsafe job generally. You want to have a level of security. So if you take that and pursue into a different path, when you take that energy and show something else, parents will back you. They will get it. And when I told my mom for the first time that I wanted to study philosophy, politics, and economics, her face like dropped. And she was like, what is this? Like philosophy? Like what job are you going to get out of that?
Yeah, literally.
And it was just, after I explained to my mom, like, it's an academic degree. I like these topics. It means I'm probably going to do quite well in them.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that, you know, I'm actually going to enjoy university and go there for more than just,
of course,
you know, that kind of rite of passage of meeting new people and all the rest of it. It's mm-hmm. like, no, I want to study.
Yeah.
Off the back of that, I'll be able to leverage, you know, other kinds of jobs.
Yeah.
But yeah, can't be a doctor off it. So, yeah, I think it's definitely a challenge most South Asian children have. And you mentioned something really interesting before, which is where sort of when you're a bit younger, mid-20s, and you have to command a level of respect amongst peers, and to a large extent with your parents and their generation, just to touch on like sort of your real estate empire. You're in Dubai, you're hustling hard, you're working hard. A lot of your clients are high net worth individuals. Yeah. I imagine, you know, they're buying 1, 2, 3, 5 million dirham properties, maybe more, on a semi-regular basis.
Yeah.
And they've got to part with a crap ton of money.
Yeah.
No matter how rich you are, there's still a chunk mm-hmm. of change. So how do you hold that space? How do you conduct yourself?
To be honest, like one of the hardest things for me initially was that being a young guy in the real estate market, you need to know your shit. Let's just say that. And to be fair, the one main thing that my boss basically came up and told me, your USP is that you're born and raised here. So you've seen that whole transition period of Dubai. So when you kind of portray that to the clients that come to me, I kind of give them the insights of what things were like before, what things are right now, and where is Dubai going? Because I'm there to see all of that happen and I've seen it. Just looking at small areas, of course, we're going a bit off topic, but just looking at some areas like downtown, that area used to be just sand. The only area you had to Sheikh Zayed Road, and then behind that was basically nothing. And that area in the last 15 years has become the hub. And that's where everyone wants to be, even for holidays, whatever it is. Now, to answer your question, now, how do I build that trust with a client? Because a 25, 26-year-old guy going up to a client who has hundreds of millions of dirhams to kind of invest into the market, why would he trust me? The main thing is first building that relationship. Like in your business as well, the main concern that people have is that guy a good guy that I can trust with my money? Because technically, I'm not a broker. Is my job is basically asset management at the end of the day, because I don't want to do a volume-based business. I want to manage portfolios. That's the difference between me and other real estate agents. So when it comes to that, let's say someone has about 5 million dirhams, they want to diversify, and you tell me, Moyes, I'm looking for 6% return every year, and this is my budget, and I'll trust you with it. My job is to then find out, create strategies, create a whole plan, make an Excel sheet, which I know you love, but you just go on the Excel, put the numbers in. The numbers need to make sense because that's the type of client you are. So I need to understand what are the priorities for each client. And that service, when I give it to them the first time, then it becomes a recurring thing. But one main thing that I realized very early on is that I need to first capitalize on the network that I already have. So looking at social media, us doing this podcast, for example, right? I think letting people know in your own community what you're doing is more important than letting some random person know what you're doing. Because that way, they're going to, first things, if they're looking to buy a property, they know that lad from DXB, which is me, Moyes, is the guy to call. At least they will ask me about it. I know that they're in the market. I can guide them in that process. Same with you, with your accountancy company. Let's say I want to do some tax return issues I have. I'm going to send them across to you because that's the first name that comes to mind.
No, it's a great answer because like establishing credibility is always the hardest thing. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the biggest power you have is well, just actually be very good at what you do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's often overlooked, yeah. Right? Because, and it's such an obvious point, and listeners might be going, well, duh, but like, it's not. Like, it genuinely yeah. is because if you're young and you're like, well, I know Uncle, he's got a chunk of money, this property makes sense, Uncle, do you want to buy this?
Yeah.
And he might go, okay, well, what do you know about the area? And if you stumble over your answer, he's not going to gain confidence.
Mm-hmm.
What are the costs I need to factor in other than the purchase of the property? You know, I want to buy this for rental purposes. Yeah. So what's the rental market like? What yield can I get? What structure should mm-hmm. I use? Should I set up a separate company or I have a company already? All these questions, these little questions, they need to be answered.
Yeah.
Because they're important and they're fundamental. Now, it might come off as a conversation just like this.
Mm-hmm.
We're hanging out, we're having a few snacks,
yeah.
we're chilling, you've got your Fanta, I've got my whiskey.
Oh, yeah.
Hint. but those little moments of establishing like, okay, I know my shit,
yeah.
is the ultimate way to create credibility. Because 100%. If someone 10 years your senior, 20 years your senior says the same thing,
mm-hmm.
it's like, okay, but I have a relationship with Moyes because I, you know, through the community, through my network.
Yeah.
He's saying the same things as you. So the credibility level is similar.
Yeah.
But I trust him more because I've known his family for so many years or I've been part of his network for so many years.
But you know what's funny? You say that, but that's not enough. Because at the end of the day, it's very important for you to know the touch points for that client every single time. I'm just going to give you a very simple example, right? If I have a client that is basically, I know he's invested in the Dubai market for the last 5-10 years. What I need to know, number one, is what type of investor is he? Is he a cash investor or is he doing financing on a regular basis? That way, I kind of know how much risk he's going to take and he's willing to take on a project. That's number one. Number two, if he owns the properties, where does he own them and which ones does he own? Just so that I'm aware of what he has. That allows me to create a touch point with him every month or two to understand, let's say the market is going up or down in that particular area. Let's take Dubai Creek Harbor, for example. The market's going up due to the reason that they've launched a new segment of that place where they're going to come up with one of the tallest towers as well. So when you come up with that type of stat, and just a simple thing, and you send an update to him saying, hi, sir, hope you're well. I just wanted to give you an update that I think the prices will be going up in the next few months. If you're interested, I would love to take on, you know, and help you out, maybe sell it or even rent it out if you want to. Because honestly, a lot of people get turned off by the fact of, I want to list your property. And the reason for that is that everyone can list it. What the hell are you bringing to the table? You need to make sure that you know what you're talking about for them to come to you and tell you that, okay, take my listing. I don't want you to list it, but try and help me out sell it, because maybe I'll give them the guidance that they need to rent it out, sell it, and give them a purpose with that property. There's a lot of people in Dubai just sitting on their property, happy with 5-6%, where they could be making more. But that's just because they're complacent with it. They bought it ages ago. They've made the money based on what they bought it at. They're making their yields. So what do you do?
What's it like to work with some of these high net worth individuals? Because I know that they are, I know some of them are part of your community, but obviously I know you've networked and you've built out your relationships. Yeah. And so now you've got a mixture of clients you've been working with for the last year plus.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? Are they genuine a category of people, or is it very much like each person is their own thing?
Each person is their own thing. And the reason for that is all of them come from a different background, and then they have different type of needs in terms of their investments. Now, most of the clients that I've dealt with are finance people, to be fair. They've been banking, they've done investment banking, some of them accountants. And when you think about those type of people, for them, the main thing is numbers. That's all they care about. I don't care what the size of the property is, but as long as the price per square foot and the average square foot range in that area is good, and I know that I can be making this yield, and you've shown me proof, and thank God for ChatGPT, DXP Interact, Bayut is a great portal to give you all the stats and seeing the transactions. If I've given them a whole case study and given it and shown it to them as like a pitch deck, for them, that's beautiful. That's all that matters. But each client will always have a different budget and different risk taking capacity. Some people might be fine with a 2 million dirham property. I could be selling it to you right now, sitting here, and you would trust me. I'm in Dubai. I've bought you the property without seeing it. People are buying off plan, right? They don't know what it looks like. So when it comes to that, I think it's just about person to person, and every deal will have its own little, let's just say, problems. Because a person might want a fully furnished apartment. They want a payment plan that will be more flexible. Some people would want that payment plan to be spread over a longer period of time. So when you consider all those factors, you need to keep in mind that each of those clients will have a different requirement, no matter how much money they have. There could be a guy who has 100 million. He might be the stingiest man you'll meet. You know, that's how it is.
Damn.
Yeah.
How do you know what buttons to press? I mean, yes, finding out the finance guys, but how do you read the person in such a way that, okay, I'm going to go down this route to satisfy your requirements?
The structure that I follow, which is the very simple thing that we follow, is that number one is qualifying the lead. So let's say, for example, someone has come to me and said, Moise, I'm looking for a property for this price. Can we have a chat? Or I will message them and have a chat with them. I, in that first meeting, need to understand the main things. Number one, are they a mortgage client or a cash client? That firstly allows me to understand and plan things out according to what their requirements are. The next thing is narrowing down on the actual budget that they could have, and based on that, find out the best financing option for them. Once I've figured those things out, that's the first thing. I can then narrow down on the locations. Now, Dubai is not the biggest place, but when you want to play around with investments on a certain budget, there's not many good places to look at, because some of them are already hitting a ceiling and some of them have the capacity to hit those numbers maybe in the next 3 or 4 years, because Dubai is growing quite big and the population's increasing. There's a lot of new things happening with road networks. The metro is coming in. Plus, they're creating the Etihad Rail, which is going to be connecting the cities from Dubai and Abu Dhabi, where you'll be there within an hour or 40 minutes. So when you think about all these factors, it's a big thing. So after that, when you've narrowed down to the location, the next big thing is the developer. Yeah. That is the biggest challenge when it comes to selling a property to anyone, because each developer now is selling a very like-for-like type of product. Let's just say this beautiful wall, okay? It's wallpaper, but some people might have the stone on it. Some people will actually cheap out and just put like a gypsum just to make it feel like it. So for some people, because they're not seeing it or not feeling it, they don't understand what the value proposition on that property would be. So I could be selling a 800 square foot one bed in, let's say, downtown for 1.9 million while buying a two bedroom in Marina, which is slightly older, but a good view, for 2.1 million. And then it's your choice as a client to understand, where can I still have long-term potential there? Which is the more interesting fact. Because what are the main things that you look at? The metrics are your ROI based on the investment you've made, where you calculate your net rental yield subtracted by your service charge per year. and then figure out how much your associated costs while doing the transaction, which is your 4% DLD, your 2% commission, all of that added together, you understand what your ROI is. Some people care about the return on equity, where they're figuring out, okay, I'm putting down 40% till the time of handover, and let's presume that I bought it for 5 million and I've sold it, I want to sell it for 7 million. On putting down 40%, that's about 1.6, 1.7 million I've put down, and I've made 2 million on top of that. For some people, that's the way they want to do business. So that's where it becomes challenging for me as an agent sometimes, there I need to figure out different things for different type of clients at the same time. And that's where, you know, you need to kind of still be on the ball, and you cannot sleep. Like, you genuinely are working on different time zones. You're working with different clients, and you have different models for each of them. But the best part about it is that once you kind of have these case studies gone, you can just keep applying them to the right type of client.
For us here in the UK, in London, we've seen like quite a few people leave the UK for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
Generally, they're wealthier. And generally, those reasons are around taxation and kind of...
We love tax.
And I think, I mean, I'll get corrected, I'm sure, but I think the number one destination for a lot of these guys is to move to the UAE, most likely Dubai.
Yeah.
Are you seeing that your end? Are you seeing a number
of
British...
Yeah. Big time. I mean, the amount of population that have come in from, I think, 2022... has been ridiculous. Like, I think even most of my family who lived in the UK have moved there and planning to move there now.
Oh, really?
Setting up businesses. Yeah. Because honestly, when it comes to also having your children around areas like London, it's not the best place in terms of safety and education, where Dubai is getting all the nice education, like companies coming in, the universities. You've got University of Birmingham, Middlesex. You've got, I think, a couple of decent Heriot Watt as well. Like, I think there's a lot of potential for people in the long run to move to Dubai for that reason. And of course, tax saving is massive. I mean, how much do people pay tax? 30%, 40% on their saved things? We pay zero.
Yeah.
And on that also, if you set up a business, you're paying 9% corporate tax after you've set a certain amount of profit per year. So when you come to those type of stats, it kind of is a no-brainer, to be honest.
So what are the pull factors to Dubai? So I know safety is one, we know education's another. What else is there?
Well, number three would be just being in the center of the world. Because first of all, if you have the British passport...
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
You are basically getting a visa for anywhere you want to travel. So connectivity becomes one of the best things. Keep in mind, most of the people in the UK come to Dubai during the winter seasons to actually come on holiday. So they kind of see that luxurious lifestyle as well that they don't see in the UK, right? And then you come up to the main thing, which is just the sizes of houses, for example. Like, you live in a 2-bed or a 3-bed in central London, all right? And you're paying the price that you would pay for an amazing villa in Dubai. So that puts it into perspective that I could be very much close to downtown. And keep in mind, again, Dubai is not the biggest place. I could be 20 minutes downtown, but it's still not that bad. Everyone drives in Dubai. Public transport is there, but really not many people need to use it. You know, the people in the lower categories of society, they have to use it. I mean, they're traveling with it, but it's connected well. But going back to that main thing, why are people moving? Again, it's luxury. The taxing is one of the main things. Plus, it's very easy to set up businesses there. People already know that a lot of the people from the UK are coming in and out of Dubai. So based on that, they found niches to connect those dots. So let's say, for example, I know someone who set up a business that they're actually helping people from the UK set up their businesses, then connecting with a real estate broker like myself, setting their whole lifestyle up and basically taking a fee for it. that is probably the smartest thing you could do, right? Because they know that they already have the circle. They're just bringing those people, guiding them in the right direction, and they're sorted.
A guest on the podcast, Natalie, wonderful woman, very successful. I'll introduce you to her actually at the right time because she'll need some guidance when she moves to Dubai. And she eloquently spoke quite passionately on this podcast about why the UK was sort of frustrating a little bit, and you know, you kind of work so hard for all this money, and like you see, as you said before, you're absolutely right, 20-30-40% sometimes close to 50% go away into tax. And she articulately understood that yes, you've got to pay your way in society, like you've got to pay for a lot of things, and the NHS is a good thing, maybe not directly, but indirectly, you know, through the people in society. You want to make sure the most vulnerable are looked after. You want to make sure kids get an education, no matter where they come from. I think that is genuinely understood.
Yeah.
And in my experience, working with people like Natalie, working with high value clients who earn well, pay a lot of tax.
Yeah.
They don't mind paying the tax.
I agree.
It's just the question I get often is, well, what am I paying for? Right? I try and get an appointment for my son for a GP. It takes 3 weeks. By the time the 3 weeks is done, whatever he had is gone.
Gone. So exactly. What's the point? Exactly.
I try and engage with my teachers on in state schools. Teachers are fantastic, but they're overwhelmed.
Yeah.
They're underpaid. They're finding it challenging to be as engaging because they've got a tough job. It's not that they're not. I mean, teachers are fantastic here. They're just struggling because it's difficult. And so on and so forth, right? If you want to, you know, get, have a court case heard, it takes several months to get things through, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a deep level of frustration here.
And that you don't get in Dubai, because honestly, Dubai's culture is based on one of the key words, as we call it, is convenience. Like, think about the smallest thing, and that's a very good point you just brought in, is that let's just talk about medical help. You've got amazing private hospitals. If you work for a decent company or even have a business, you actually have to get some insurance, which is not too bad. I mean, you'll pay tax to get NHS services.
Yeah,
I don't mind paying 3,000-4,000 dirhams a year and being taken care of. How many times am I really going to the hospital in a year?
Yeah.
Think about it that way, right? Appointments, you can get it right away. Each thing has an application. You go through, you're in the hospital on the same day and you're sorted out. Then when it comes to schools as well, the waiting list that you have, there's a proper structure there as well. A lot of these schools have waiting lists, but there's other schools that you can go to that are like for like, and they allow you to go wherever you want, which is great. Then you get to the convenience of just life. Think about grocery stores. It is one of the things in COVID time that I loved, which was that online ordering became easier. Nowadays, you don't see as many people at the grocery shops in Dubai as much as you see deliveries coming in. People are getting these big cartons of their weekly grocery stores coming into the house. Imagine, on a weekly basis. Happens in my house every day. I am sick and tired of opening the door every morning and seeing groceries, you know what I mean? And honestly, that type of life, obviously everyone wants to live, because at that point you're saving time, no hassle. You're actually saving money on fuel and stuff as well, to be fair.
Yeah.
Brings me to the fuel prices then. Fuel prices in the Middle East are the cheapest. I mean, what's the fuel price right now in the UK?
Oh, it's crazy. It's like, I think it's unleaded, I think it was most common at £1.37 a litre.
There you go.
Which is quite a chunk. I don't know. I think you guys do gallons, right?
Yeah, so we do gallons. It's 2.7 dirhams, which is... like
2.7 dirhams a gallon.
Yeah. Not a gallon, litres.
A litre.
A litre.
So 2.7 dirhams.
So that's about, what,
75p? Jesus. I didn't realize it was that. Literally half the price.
I mean, half the price.
Makes sense given you make the oil in the UAE, but like it's still
that's not the big difference. The
oil, you extract it. But that's insane.
Yeah. Think about it. So when you consider that into the, like, imagine you're driving, I don't mean to be rude, but a shitty hatchback in the UK, spending £60-70 on your fuel. I spent 100 dirhams on my car and lost me a whole week.
Yeah.
So no matter how much you say Dubai is expensive, then this is a topic we'll have later on, but the Dubai to London lifestyle differences. But it's crazy when you can make those small changes. Like, I don't need to drive a V8. That doesn't mean I drive a V8 if it's cheap, but I can still be smart about it.
Yeah.
And then the best thing is also you can get your fuel done at home. There's something called Carrefour, right?
Yeah.
They were the first ones during COVID. They were coming into your house in a truck, filling up your car, and that's about it. You just have to book a slot. That's about it. And it's the same price.
The same price. Yeah, that was incredible. So, so you're basically, you're saving because they have the cost of delivery.
Now they've started charging you a certain fee, which is still not bad. That's like £2 extra for that convenience. Fine. Why not?
Yeah. It saves you the time of
literally
20 minutes going there and whatever.
Yeah.
And it actually comes to mind because, I mean, I've had this conversation with a number of clients, I'm sure you can imagine. But it actually comes to mind, A, because obviously, I think it was literally the last episode, but... B, what I was hearing from her wasn't actually the cost. It was more the control.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, if you make, you know, X amount in your business and 20, 30, 40% is going to the tax man,
mm-hmm.
you're kind of going, okay, but if I took, let's just use random numbers. Let's say you've got 100 and you're being taxed 30%.
Yeah.
So that 30 that you've got that you're giving to the tax mm-hmm. man here, you're assuming all these services, right?
Yeah.
And a number of other things. But in Dubai, you don't have any of that.
No,
you get rid of the 30, you don't have to pay, but within that budget, you have to pay for slightly more expensive groceries, because mm-hmm. to be fair, everything is imported.
Yeah.
But fuel, cheaper.
Cheaper.
Fine. Whereas here, there's VAT, there's duties on it,
mm-hmm.
Which is probably accounts for that difference, it to be does. Honest with you.
I mean, we have VAT as well, but that's 5%.
Yeah, 20.
Yeah. Sorry,
yeah. Four times difference. Yeah. You guys are winning. And then you've got, as you said before, two of the biggest things, health and education. Now, health, I think you just mentioned about 4,000 dirhams. Let's elevate that a little bit to 4,500. Because it's about one, right now, it's about £1 to 4.6, mm-hmm. 4.7-ish dirhams. So £1,000 a year.
Pretty much.
Which I think the principle of having something free at the point of service, which is in the UK, makes sense.
Yeah.
For us now, and we've had this for... 90 years almost. I mean, it is incredible. The NHS is incredible. And as a young boy, I've definitely used it a lot. Like, I've broken most parts of my body.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, if you're saying that it's, let's say, £800-900 a year for private insurance to cover a lot of these things.
Yeah.
Sounds reasonable. Education, I mean, what would be like an average college, right, or an average school?
See, now,
school?
Education is a tricky one because it depends on what type of social class do you want to be in. So you've got the lower tier ones, decent education. It's almost like a public school in the UK. But at the end of the day, they still have good type of people. It's in a good location. They have a good syllabus. That's fine. But when you're looking at the more nicer ones where those kids want to study abroad, get into universities easily, you're studying A-levels or IB, your rough... fees, at least at my time, when I graduated in 2017, was about 65,000 dirhams. That's about £10,500 a year. Okay. But the funny thing is, my nieces and nephews, when they were in Dubai right now, their fees in year two was 75,000 dirhams. In year two. Now, I'm talking about my fees in year 13. So just considering those facts, you're looking at about 100,000 dirhams per kid per year on education for a very good education. And even if you want to average that out, you're looking at anywhere 60 to 70 now, which is crazy when you think about it, because that's not the only cost. Let's think about transport as well. The buses, or even if you put like a carpooling situation, or you pay a driver, which is the most common thing in Dubai, it's expensive. I mean, the driver takes about 3,000 to 4,000 dirhams in salary. Then you have to pay for their visa. So that's another cost. And just your miscellaneous costs with kids in general is expensive, because you have your birthday parties, you have to look good in front of the other kids. They might be some sheikh's son or daughter, and you have to compete with that standard. Like, it becomes challenging.
Okay, so education is probably where costings are a little bit up there.
Yeah, and again, it depends on the type of job you're in. So like a good thing in Dubai is that there is a lot of allowances that good companies give you. So for kids, for example, my sister, she worked for the Mars chocolate brand.
Okay.
All right. Wow. And she did very well. And now she's in Canada working there. But what she got was that the company paid 60% off the fees.
Brilliant.
And that takes away pretty much the major chunk of it, right? Oh. So, and that way she can put that money into something else, which she did, which she was smart about it, and she put it into real estate. And she did that early on. So now it's basically accumulating.
What about other sort of costs that maybe people don't necessarily see?
Well, you've got your social expense, which is one of the most expensive things in Dubai. If you compare, let's just talk about going out on a dinner, okay? a nice, decent dinner in Dubai would be about £20 per person. Well, in the UK as well, is roughly around there. But you know what? The quality I'm getting in Dubai is much, much better, generally, because I know for a fact that this is imported goods, number one. So I'm already putting that on a pedestal. The other thing is that it's the location where that restaurant is. So you've got really cool places, and you've been there as well. You've been to downtown, you've been to DIFC, you've been to, let's say, the Al-Wasl, Dar Al-Wasl, which is this beautiful place. And honestly, the food quality, you can't beat it. And a lot of people love that. The concepts you get in that country is just out of the world, to be fair.
Hi, I'm Laura.
And I'm Adam.
And we're the hosts of the Persuasion Game podcast.
Each episode, we meet with marketers and business leaders to understand how they grow their brands and influence their consumers.
You recently pulled out three principles to great portfolio strategy. Are you able to sort of summarise those?
And show you're working.
I will do my best.
For more of the strategy behind how brands persuade their consumers, listen to the Persuasion Game.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming back to a couple of points we made earlier,
yeah,
especially for business people here, entrepreneurs here, control is a huge element.
Big time.
Because part of our lives very often, if you're just told, like, you make all this money, you make all these decisions, you pick your clients, you run your operational costs, you pick your office, all this stuff, everything's in your control.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you're like, oh, by the way, that money you just made, 25%.
This has gone out.
Go straight out the door.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, hang on a second, whoa, like, that's fine, but if I'm paying for my office, I'm getting that office.
Yeah.
If I'm paying for this person, I'm getting that person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paying for this tax, I'm getting what now? I get one vote in this whole tens of millions mm-hmm. of society, and it might not be what I get, what yeah. I want. So the engagement level drops
big time.
Your resentment level increases.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you do get the right party or the one you voted yeah. for, are they actually going to fulfill the promises that True. They made? True. So I get, obviously, democracy and the kind of system makes a lot of sense,
mm-hmm.
but it does build a level of frustration and resentment in people
for sure
when it comes to taxation. Whereas in Dubai, whilst things are probably quite expensive, and I would probably argue that you may not save money from like the tax to cost of living mm-hmm. comparison. I think the control
is
where people reconcile the difference and go, do you know what? Actually, I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yes, I have to pay for education, but you know what? I'm paying for a blank check on stuff I can't control, yeah. but at least I've picked that school for my child and they're getting mm-hmm. that level of education.
That's true. I mean, honestly, it's all about how you live your life. You need to kind of figure out how you want to budget it. What's your ratio of living your life? So let's say, for example, you want to prioritize your social life more than anything. So you will live in the fancier place where your budget goes up. You want to live, you want to eat certain type of food, then your cost goes up. So maybe you will compromise on your car maybe. Let's just say, you know, and I think that's the challenge that people seem to face in London itself, because they want to live that expectation, but the tax just kind of brings that down. So when you're in the UAE, I think the next point that I want to bring up is the money.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed-sponsored jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed-sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Making opportunities that you have in the UAE compared to London and the UK much higher. There's niche for everywhere, and you can connect with each other country to work in, like, in terms of trading itself. Just think about it, it's a trade hub. You've got massive ports coming in with products. If you want to get into the service industry, there's multiple service. The best one, consulting. Like, you could be sitting anywhere in the world consulting and making tax-free money if you're registered in the UAE. Why would you not do that? Right? And then that way, you're living your lifestyle the way you want to. You don't need to spend money on it. You can buy the property, rent it out, and let that rent pay your house. That's one way to look at it. But obviously, I'm speaking like this as a unmarried man. Of course, when marriage comes into play.
For now.
For now. So once that comes into the picture, it's a different situation.
Yeah. I know you've had businesses in the past, successful, profitable businesses. Mm-hmm. You've touched on some of them before. So let's touch on, actually, let's go deep dive. So you, since your first business was a marketing agency, right?
Well, if you want to go deep diving, we start from the bottom of it, all right? Like right at the start.
Let's do it.
So when I graduated from school, I decided to take a gap year during that time. And the reason I wanted to do that was to kind of figure out what I wanted to do, like we discussed earlier.
What year is this? Just so
this is 2017 to 2018. That was the time I took my gap year off. Now, during that time, me and one of my boys, we were like kind of linking up at the gym. We were big gym lads at that point. We wanted to kind of get into the meal plan business.
Mm.
So the moment we got into that, I thought, okay, you know what? There's many things we can do. And we actually started the cloud kitchen business before it was a thing in Dubai.
Oh.
And what we did was we knew a lot of restaurant owners that weren't doing too well in the areas like Al Khuz or Al Barsha, which are not the best places, but they have good businesses and small kitchens. So what we did was we went to these businesses, pitched them an idea where we do a revenue share. And that way we're going to bring you clients and then get everything sorted. That was the first business I started. That ran for about 2 years. But the problem was that once I moved out of Dubai to go to university at that time to study sports science and nutrition, hence why I did nutrition because of that business. Makes sense, huh? I realized I don't need nutrition to do this business. I need business to do this business. So,
fair enough.
So there you go. And after having that whole conversation with my father, I decided to move back. And when I got back, one of my really good friends who I played cricket with, thanks to sport, the networking was fantastic, right? So he actually wanted someone to come and help him out with business development for his marketing agency. And honestly, I had a lot of time in my hands because I barely went to uni. I used to ditch classes, do all that type of shit. I was like, might as well make some money on the side.
Yeah.
So I joined him to kind of help him out, kind of understand the market as well. Yeah. And that way I was going to interact with business owners, which was my plus point that I was seeing. I didn't care about the money. It was more about the networking aspect. So that was the first proper job, I would say, that I had in my life.
Hmm.
And the moment I did that, because I was working under somebody, I had certain ideas that I wanted to bounce off and kind of do. I kind of got shat on pretty much by the guy. And to be fair, it was fine, but you know, because I had a friendly relationship with him as well. So out of the office, it would be different, and in the office, it would be different. So the moment I realized that type of difference in the mentality that we had, because of course, it's his business. I can't really make changes. I can only advise. So I realized at that point, I need to figure out an exit strategy where I figured out I could do this on my own. I've built a good relationship with people. I don't need to take clients. I can find my own clients the same way I'm doing right now with the least amount of capital put down. So then I had someone else come and approach me that they wanted to set up a tech company where they wanted to create CRMs. And what he wanted to also add on was the marketing aspect for that.
Okay.
So the marketing bridge would be handled by me and he would handle the CRM. So we got into that, and honestly, best decision I could have asked for, because I've realized that I had full control. I knew the type of clients I wanted to deal with. I'm sorry, but I'm just an attractive guy sometimes in terms of business, because when people do business with me, they don't want to leave it in a way, because I've given them that family type of environment.
Mm.
They trust me in the way that, okay, if Moises said it, we'll go ahead with it. And in marketing, you know it, you do marketing yourself. I think the key understanding you need to have is making that business your own. Like, I'm pretty sure you saw my videos I was doing for other companies just because I actually cared about it. Some people would charge you for that. I didn't charge anything. So those clients then asked me that, okay, I want to leave the company you were in and join you now. But then obviously there's some conflict of interest that happens. So I realized how to play around it. Mm. They left it. 2 months later, I get a call. Okay, now I'm going to join you. Fair enough. So the first challenge that I had with that business was just getting the operations right, because the initial model was that we were going to work with people in India and Pakistan as graphic designers to kind of do our work. But when you do that, you're not keeping in mind that they also have other projects that they're working on. Mm. So the deadlines were not being met.
Yeah.
The moment that happens, the client's trust in you goes down.
Yeah.
Even though you might have a good relationship with them, but they will respect you enough to tell you that, look, you're doing a shit job. So that was the first challenge that we overtook. And then we realized, okay, we need to have someone in-house. Hired someone in-house. Cost has gone up. So slowly, slowly, just to kind of speed the process up, we were like, okay, let's hire two people, one videographer, one photographer, and they're both are graphic designers. Great. Sorted. Then we moved on with, at one point, had 15 clients, which was fantastic. We had retainers starting from 4,000 dirhams all the way up to 8,000 to 10,000 dirhams. And to be honest, when you think about the margins, great margins, the numbers made sense. But the problem came when ego comes into play. Obviously, I had not invested in this business. I had equity in the business, but I didn't know what to do. So this guy has come up to me and said, look, I like the way you're working, but where's my name?
Interesting.
The moment that happens, bro, you know you're about to get put on the sidelines and then he's going to take over. And that's exactly what started happening. Going into meetings, he wanted to be there. Going into, like, let's say a shoot, he wanted to be the lead guy, even though I know my ideas are better, but you figure it out. And honestly, that made me realize that my age was the big factor there. He's a 43-year-old guy. I'm a 25-year-old guy, 24 at the time. So obviously he's expecting me to be undermined completely.
Mm.
So at that point, that was the realization I needed. I worked for that business for about a year and a half. After that, I realized, okay, you know what? Let's see what happens. So I kept going. And then because we were specializing in real estate marketing, which was the best thing I could have done, that gave me enough knowledge and confidence to kind of diversify into going and selling the properties, because I knew what I needed to do. I had the whole, like, you know, system in place, and I knew the right people. Mm. And luckily I met Mr. Palm Jumeirah. Shout out to him. He is one of the best people I've ever met in my life in terms of real estate. Man has a lot of experience, worked for big companies like Sotheby's, Knight Frank, leaded a directing company, Eva, Dubai, massive, massive guy. And he specialized in Palm Jumeirah itself. So working with a guy like that, there was multiple things that you get out of it. Number one is the experience. I take him as a mentor to me, because he has taken me into rooms where I'm sitting with these guys who own 200 million dirhams worth of property. And being the biggest flex that we get is that we work on the Palm. Yeah. Our office is on the Palm. So with that, you get a lot of clout and credibility as well. So working under him, he offered me a job to kind of see how things go. We were restructuring, kind of figure it out. I was like, okay, you know what? I've just left this business, so we'll figure it out. And since that time, that was about mid-August, around this time of last year, he offered me the job. I joined it in September. And alhamdulillah, bro, it has been the best decision I've ever made in my life.
How have you dealt with people that have, I mean, you have one business partner that had a bit of ego.
Mm-hmm.
You dealt with him by...
Just leaving.
Which is fair.
Yeah.
and that's important.
Yeah.
Because sometimes solutions provided are, well, no, just fight through it. You know, make them understand, make them feel appreciated, mm-hmm. learn how to work with them, learn what their work language is, all that kind of stuff. Sometimes it's like, you know what? You're a prick. And I'm not going to work with you because you can't handle it. You've changed. Yeah. Something has happened. I'm not going to use up valuable time dealing with this. It's a big decision to take. And I don't advise it all
the time. Of course not.
And you wouldn't. You've put so much effort and time to get to that level.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But sometimes, I'm not calling this guy a prick, but I've never met him before. But I'm just saying, I'm just assuming that the ego got in the way.
Yeah. And,
do you know what? Dude, I'm a young guy. I need to make every day count.
Exactly.
So I'm going to respectfully leave, sort of my own thing. If you're in a better place, let's talk. If you're not, I'm cool.
I'm cool. Exactly.
But you must have met other people with varying degrees of, say, ego or other challenges.
Yeah.
How have you fought through that?
It's about the relationship you have with that person, which is the most important thing. So I think with the business partner that I was with, because he was much older than me, I saw him as an older brother the way I see you as well, right? I'm seeing him that, okay, he's going to guide me. So I'm trying to figure out, how am I supposed to deal with this situation without also hurting my relationship outside the office? So for me, figuring that out was the biggest challenge. And honestly, thanks to my father, I honestly respect him a lot. He is the most patient man I've ever met in my life. And because of that reason, I have an very angry side as well, but it takes a lot for me to get to that stage. So just kind of dealing with those situations with normal communications, just as you would do with any sort of relationship. That's how I dealt with that. And that's what I would do with any other situation as well. If I have a client who's unhappy with our service, let's just take that for example, I would make them sit down, figure out what the issues are. If I know that it's my issue, accept it, screw it. Most of the times customers are right. I'll listen to them, take the feedback. If there's a way I can compensate them, because that will allow them to realize that I know I've made a mistake and I can kind of keep this relationship going, that's what I need to do. And some people might take it. Some people might be like, Moise, I don't need that. I just wanted you to understand that this is the situation and that's about it. So I think that's how I would deal with situations like that, whatever it may be, in a calm and decent manner, because I don't think, like, it's like our mother shouting at us, you know, why is the fucking slippers there and why are you not cleaning your room? It's very similar to clients. If my mother says that in a nice way, I might actually clean my room, you know. If the client is telling me in a nice way, I should reply in a nice way. It's as simple as that.
Makes sense. And I think a lot of entrepreneurship, sometimes you come across like the tough conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is an art form to manage that. Because sometimes clients' expectations are a little bit crazy. I mean, I deal with it all the time. Sometimes a client will be like, why is my tax bill so high? I'm like, well, you did like double your revenue. So if you've doubled your money, you would expect your tax bill to increase a little bit. And they're like, well, I don't like it. Just make it the same as last year.
Yeah.
And you're like, what do you mean make it the same? I'm not making anything. Yeah. Yet. Like, it's a reflection of your success. So it's, but having that tough conversation about, look, what is the issue here? Like, can you not afford this tax bill, or has it come at the wrong time, or are you frustrated that, you know, coming back to the control point again, that your bill's gone up but you're not getting value for it? So like, last year you spent 20k, now it's 45k or whatever. Mm-hmm. I know you're more successful, but it still stings.
Yeah.
So what's the issue? How can I help you with that? How can I help you rationalize it? But that's obviously, that's one part. But having developing an art form around those tough conversations, I find, is actually one of the big differentiators in successful entrepreneurs, because it's not only having the conversation, but when to have the conversation. Timing is vital. So do you feel that sometimes how you're managing clients, it takes a certain tone, a certain way? Can you provide some tips on that?
100%. I think each client comes with a different mindset to you, right? And just the gender makes a difference. With women, I think I'm more soft, more friendly. Because the more professional you are, they might take you too seriously and then not be interested in the conversation itself. And with men, it's more like understanding that man's ideology and how much time that person has to give you. So if they don't have much time, you've got to be straight to the point. You need to be direct. You need to, if that guy is a numbers guy, I need to be just putting the numbers. If he wants more insights, I need to summarize it in a way that he will understand it, and that's it. You know, we can make a decision right away. So those are the different things that I've faced, because I've had couples that have come and looked at property, right? Now, the wife will have certain requirements. I want the kitchen to be closed kitchen. I want these cupboards in this place. The husband has come. He's like, I've got two parkings. The bedroom is nice. I've got cupboards. Great. Great. I'll take it.
Yeah.
But the woman, you need to get really emotionally involved. So that's the interesting part about selling houses, because the visualization will only come from the women, not from the man. Unless that guy is buying it for himself, like a single man or an unmarried man, that's a different story. But taking that wife around, oh, you know what? An L sofa would look really nice there. Oh, you know what? You could host some kiddie parties for yourself. Open up the windows and have the pool view open up. That type of stuff changes the perspective and then gives them like that connection that you understand them. And that's what's most important with any type of client in any business, right? And you just need to figure out what are the touch points that you need to focus on and then take it from there.
I find it challenging, because you find a lot of entrepreneurs who consistently want to be like the nice guy. They want to be the person that is always smiling and kind of keeping everyone happy and managing expectations and all of that. And one of the things I learned very well, because I was very much like that. I completely agree. First, like 6 months, I was just trying to I was like, I'm the service industry. Everyone needs to be happy with me. And sometimes a client hasn't paid their bill for 5 years. I can't be like, oh, yeah, he must have had a really tough time in the last 5 years. you couldn't afford 1 year's worth of fees, or you couldn't afford a small direct debit or something. But, you know, and Yisha helped me realize this, actually. She was like, look, like, your strength is being the nice guy. Don't not be the nice guy, because the friendliness is what makes people feel comfortable with you, build trust and credibility, etc. Don't lose that bit. But someone is screwing you, or not paying your bill, or lying to you, or doing something. Not everyone is as nice or friendly as that person. So take a tougher stance. And that, I found that very unnatural. We've got a closing tradition on this show.
Mm-hmm.
It's a final question we ask every guest.
Right.
And that question is, if your 18-year-old self had a conversation with your 80-year-old self.
80.
80. What would the conversation be about?
Well, why the hell did you not become an athlete? Would be the first thing that comes to mind. Honestly, I think if I had started up early and had the courage to go to my dad and be like, I want to go full-time into it. I want to become disciplined, go join the academies properly and do one-on-one training. I think I could have got to a certain level, definitely. Mm. Because I think we've played cricket together. You've seen me around. I mean, if without putting effort, if we're doing these type of things, if I put effort, where would I be? I always question that. That's the first question I would do. Second question would be, all right, at 18-year-old, did you expect yourself to be at this stage at 80? Because honestly, just between 18 and 28 right now, I'm turning 28 next year, I've achieved so many good things. Forget about the money. It's just about the people that I've met and the experiences that I've got. I want to understand whether that was enough.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And honestly, with that, I don't even know if I'm going to live till 80, to be fair. So,
oh, come on, guys. None of that. That's a strange amount. You're probably like the fifth or sixth guest that have said that. I don't even know if I'm going to survive till 80. You're going to survive till 80, bro.
I hope so.
You're a healthy guy. You go to the gym. You eat well.
Well, you know good what? Genes, other than that, bro, the pressures of life and real estate might get to me at some point.
I think for me, the conversation would be around whether I achieve my goals and whether I made an impact on the world. Because one of my goals is to make every SME on the planet 1% better. And it's an ambitious goal, but it's because I believe in the power of the little guys doing a small thing, but at scale. And in the UK, for example, we have about 5.5 million SMEs. If they all improve 1%, I'm using 1%, you know, colloquially.
Yeah,
I'm not literally saying 1% revenue. £5 or whatever. But I'm saying, look, if they hired an extra person, if they thought about their community a little bit more, if they were a little bit more profitable and able to spend a bit better, invest a little bit more in their own business, if they're able to interact with bigger companies more, sell themselves a little bit better, either actually so that, you know, they can go to a bigger scale, or just the product or service they provide, the world will change for the better. And where you see, I believe, the most impact in local communities, which I think is desperately needed right now in the Western world, it's those local communities. It's those local businesses that, it's we won't use Bob, let's say John, because Bob's the bad one. John's a good one. Sorry, Bob's, but, you know, it's just a name. But John from down the road who hires 10 guys, and let's say he's in the construction industry. And he's a good guy. You know, he's trying to pay people fairly, he's trying to do good, honest work. Maybe one or two of the guys in the team, maybe they come from rough backgrounds, and he's taking them under his wing to kind of look after them, keep them off the streets, doing something a bit stupid, but he's paid them a decent wage, so they've got a future and a hope. That happens from a guy like John, because the big guys, they've got the HR policies, they've got the formalities. You don't see that shot given. Maybe some, you know, whatever, once in a while. But with SMEs, with my clients for sure, it happens every day. And it's amazing. And I genuinely am inspired. Like, they go like, do you know what? I'll take a shot on that person. And we do that. I'm really proud that we do it at our company. I mean, one of our amazing people, she hadn't worked at all in her entire career. Like, she didn't. She was a mother early. She gave birth to two beautiful children. They're doing very, very well. And she approached us a couple of years ago through one of my existing employees, and she was like, I just want to work. I just want to, you know, feel valued, and I just, you know, I'm not asking for a big wage. I just want to kind of be in the office and experience. And I said, And I could have said, well, I'm looking for like a secretary, I'm looking for like an office manager. I need a bit of experience through here. But when you look someone in the eye and you're like, they're earnest, they'll deal with things with a level of integrity. They'll support you and they'll be great for the culture and the team. Do you know what? Like, do you know, go, oh, fine. You know what? Come on board. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can make that decision because I'm the owner and I'm there.
Yeah.
And obviously Yesha makes that decision, but the true owner. But you know, but you can do that.
Yeah.
And I'm really proud. And I look at her now. Honestly, I look at her every day. I walk past. She sits near the end of the door.
Yeah.
And I look at her. I'm like, you know what? You're doing so well. I'm so proud of you. And she was even talking to me the other month about like, oh, maybe I can do a couple of accountancy exams. Oh, wow. I was like, dude, you're blowing my mind here.
You just
like,
want to keep improving.
Yeah. Right? And you get physically excited about seeing that person improve.
Yeah.
Now, if in my little world, right, I can do this one thing for this person, or in some of our other businesses, we have this one little thing. We offer a little internship to someone who otherwise maybe not would have had the ability to get that internship because they've come through a charity or from a local college. But I know through my network, there are other SMEs doing, you know, great things. If they can do that, I would love to have that conversation with my 80-year-old self and be like, did we achieve it? Because I might not even have had to have that conversation because you'd see it. And I strongly believe that if we do those little things, and for those that know the ecosystem and trying to create and primarily supporting SMEs and helping them get to the next level and improve to get into their 1%, they will see that. Then, you know, you just make try and make an impact on the world.
Of course, that's beautiful, man. I think that way you kind of know, have you achieved something pretty much? And that's the goal you've set yourself for the long run. And I think that was a goal that you set yourself probably before you got into this business anyways, right?
Honestly speaking, I think you're right to make that assumption, but honestly speaking, I didn't.
Oh, you didn't?
I was, when I took over my father's business, I hated the fact that I was sitting in that seat for obvious reasons. Because I was sitting here being like, well, my dad's dead and I'm sitting here because he's dead.
Yeah.
And I'm having to muscle through all this work in his name.
That's also be emotional.
I have no idea who these clients are. I know out of the 700, 800 of them they had at the time, I know maybe like 20 of them.
Oh, wow.
And most of them know me as like a little kid. Now I'm giving them tax advice. Yeah. It's a different ballgame.
Yeah.
And I hated it. And then over time, I kind of appreciated why my father enjoyed it because it was helping people.
Right.
It was doing good, honest work and just making sure they were, you know, paying the right taxes, getting their forms in. It's just nice, honest work.
Yeah, fair enough.
And then over time, I think I really understood why he enjoyed it, which was that you're making an impact on people, that through your skill set, it can be just a little thing, just filing a tax return. And there are some clients, you file a tax return and they're the happiest people on the planet. And you're like, why are you so happy for? Like, you sent me the information yesterday. The team drafted it.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, I reviewed it. It's fine. You've done it. And you paid me all within a few days. And you're the happiest person that you've recommended me to 10 people. I'm like, what is going on here? And it's just like, but it's just nice that you just did what you said you were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to really appreciate that, because I was like, obviously you asked me to do something, of course I'm going to do it,
but not many people do that, right? That's the problem.
And I learned that actually the level of integrity that you were talking about before, honesty, lack of ego, you start to realize that you can read people better by seeing them in these kind of little moments and how they treat people. And I think now I profoundly understand why my father sat in that seat, why he loved what he did, the impact he had on people, and just appreciating, you know, just doing the little things for people, holding your word as much as you possibly can. Obviously no one's perfect, but just like having that goal, and you know, you will make a difference
for sure. And that's beautifully said, man.
And that's but you're right, like I should have. Normally people, entrepreneurs in particular, you think they have this early goal from when they were like 12 and they're going to change the world and then set up this business. Like, it's not how it works.
But honestly, it keeps changing as well. I think you probably agree with it, right? Like your targets every, let's say 2 to 3 years, there's a new thing that happens. Maybe your target might be the 1% change in SMEs, but you might fine tune it to kind of become more specific over time. And then you want to kind of just focus yourself into that goal on the long run. And I think that's the same with me as well, to be fair. It's the same thing. I want to make sure that I help, I mean, not only the rich people get richer, but the people who want to make some good money and make some good investments, guide them in the right direction. Yeah. Push them towards real estate, because I think people underestimate real estate. They think it's a bubble for the longest time, especially the buy real estate. A lot of people have thought that. And my biggest goal is in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years, is that get that whole perception away and make people realize that actually, if you do it smartly, you get the financing right, you stick with the right person, which is me, then you'll get what you want. But let's not set our goals way too high. Let's be realistic. And I'm the type of guy who would go and tell them, look, if you want to do this, it's a dumb idea. If you want to do this, maybe we can make something work. So you have to be honest, like you said. I think the integrity and credibility situation is the most important to sort out.
Well, that's a great note to finish on. Yeah. Boys, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. You're a good man.
Thank you, sir. Been a pleasure.
Take care. Thank you very much, guys.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.